Turn with me in your Bibles to Revelation chapter 21. We continue with our ongoing Sunday morning series entitled Reclaiming the Kingdom, Studies in the Book of Revelation. This is the last message in the series, message number 29. I'm going to read Revelation 21 verses 9 through 23 to start the message. Verse 9, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked with me, saying, Come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her light was like a most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. Also she had a great and high wall with 12 gates, and 12 angels at the gates, and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates, and its wall. The city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length, breadth, and height are equal. Then he measured its wall, 144 cubits. According to the measure of a man, that is, of an angel. The construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. Verse 19, the foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was of one pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. But I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city had no need of the sun or of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. I've titled the message, The Return of Eden. From the very beginning of creation, God's intention has been to dwell together with his creation in a place of holiness. We see this in the earth that God recreated nearly 6,000 years ago. Not only did he recreate earth, he put on it a special place known as Eden, and it had a garden. In Genesis 3, verse 8, we read of Jehovah God, literally Yahweh Elohim, walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And there he communed with the first people, Adam and Eve. But after Adam and Eve sinned, they hid themselves from the Creator. The implication is that they had formerly communed with him openly, but sin compromised their fellowship, and so they were expelled from the garden. It is my understanding, and I'm not alone in this, many commentators take this position, that Eden was like a temple, the place of God's dwelling, and the garden was like the courtyard where man dwelt and communed with God in all his glory. That was before the fall. I believe Eden and the Garden of Eden in Genesis are one and the same as the New Jerusalem in Revelation chapters 21 and 22. They were originally placed on earth as God's dwelling place, his temple, where man had free access, the garden and the broader territory of Eden. Of course, when man sinned, he was banned from the garden, but it remained connected with earth, nonetheless, guarded by cherubim. Now, perhaps some have suggested that God caused the garden to be lifted above the earth in a position of hovering, as it will apparently be in the millennium. We don't know for sure, But either way, it seems men could see the garden or the city from a distance, but could not enter it. Apparently, God removed it to heaven at the time of the flood, for it was not seen after the flood, though Abraham looked for it. Hebrews 11:10, he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. How did Abraham know to look for this city? Well, one possibility, think of this. Noah lived 350 years after the flood, and his son Shem lived 500 years after the flood. Noah would have overlapped Abraham by 58 years, if Usher's chronology is correct, and Shem would have overlapped him by 208 years. They're all in the same lineage. You think they would have talked with one another? Undoubtedly. And I think it's very likely that Noah or Shem could have told Abraham about the New Jerusalem / Garden of Eden that hovered over earth before the flood. In fact, some commentators think that Shem may have built the Giza pyramid in Egypt as a memorial of the New Jerusalem that had previously hovered in the heavens. Very speculative, but it's a possibility. We know that Abraham looked for the city. Perhaps he constantly looked into the heavens to see if he could get a glimpse, just longing for that place. Abraham's grandson Jacob, whose name was later changed to Israel, did get a glimpse of the Garden of Eden, New Jerusalem, when he beheld a ladder or a stairway from earth to the heavens, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon it. At the top stood God and reconfirmed the promises to Jacob that he had previously made to Abraham. After seeing the New Jerusalem, do you remember what Jacob exclaimed? Genesis 28:16, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." And he was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." He named the place Bethel, meaning house of El, house of God. Later, Moses was allowed to see the heavenly tabernacle, probably Eden, New Jerusalem, and from that he patterned the earthly tabernacle, which later became the template for the temple as well. And we read that in Hebrews 8 and verse 5. Priests serve the copy and shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle, for he said, quote, "See that you make all things according to the pattern shown to you on the mountain," end quote. So Moses saw this somehow on the top of Mount Sinai, maybe in a vision, maybe he was transported to see it. We don't know the details, but he saw this place, New Jerusalem, Garden of Eden, the temple in the heavenlies, whatever you want to call it. Yet Revelation 21 describes New Jerusalem as having no temple. So how do we explain this? Revelation 21:22, "But I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple." Here's how I understand it. New Jerusalem is the temple. It's called a holy city. In Revelation 21, verse 2, "coming down from God out of heaven." Jesus later told Nathanael about this place, for he was an Israelite without guile. And I take that to mean that Jesus viewed Nathanael as qualified to inherit the kingdom because of the way he was living righteously. Thus, it was appropriate for him to learn about the New Jerusalem, in which he would share a part at some future point. What was once the holy place of God's dwelling on earth, with righteous man allowed free access, will once again be God's holy place of dwelling on earth, and righteous man again allowed free access. New Jerusalem, the Garden of Eden, will be limited to faithful saints only, those who qualify to be the bride of Christ. New Jerusalem will come down from heaven to earth during the millennium. That's the first round. From the ladder shown to Jacob and to Nathanael, it would appear that it will not actually connect with earth during the millennium, but will hover over the earth and be accessed via some type of stairway. That's really what the word ladder means. It's a stairway. When the new earth is created, long at the end of the ages, the new earth, then New Jerusalem will descend once again from heaven and actually connect with earth, much like the Garden of Eden in the original creation. I don't know about you, but the thought of this to me is spectacular, and it rejoices my heart to think that God once dwelt with man on this earth in his temple, his garden, his Eden, if you will, his paradise. And that has all been done away with for the time being because of the curse of sin, but it will come back partially in the millennium, at least for the faithful saints. And then New Jerusalem will come back and connect with earth, the new earth, and God will dwell with man. That's just beautiful, God's plan. So Eden will return, and I believe it will be the new Jerusalem. They're one and the same in my way of thinking. And again, I'm not alone in that. Many take this position. Now, why do we assume that New Jerusalem and Eden are the same? Let me give you a few reasons. First, Genesis 2 verse 10 says a river flowed from Eden to water the garden. And you can compare that with Revelation 22 verse 1. He showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. This water undoubtedly brings quality of life, an enhancement of rewards. We probably don't begin to understand all that's encompassed in this river flowing through this garden, this New Jerusalem. It's probably very grand, far beyond maybe even our understanding. Secondly, why do we assume New Jerusalem and Eden are the same? Because the fact that a river flowed from Eden and watered the garden implies that the garden was elevated, perhaps like a mountain. That's where most rivers begin, in the mountains. We know that New Jerusalem is also a mountain of sorts. Look at Revelation 21:10. He carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem. Some commentators believe that Eden was once located at earthly Jerusalem, that may have been the location of the Garden of Eden when it was here on earth. Now, that could be. There are some evidences that point in that direction, other evidences that would point in another direction, further east, but I don't have the time to get into all that today. That's for another time. Regardless, the earthly Jerusalem was and is a mountain. Psalm 48:2, beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth, is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. We know that earthly Jerusalem, particularly the tabernacle and later the temple, is patterned after the heavenly Jerusalem, which will one day come down from heaven and hover over the earth. What does this city look like? Well, look at Revelation 21:10. He carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. It's likened to a mountain, which I've already mentioned, and that means it's likely a pyramid shape. Mountains are not square. Mountains are triangular in shape, much like a pyramid. In fact, some of you that subscribe to the Epoch Times might have noticed an article that they ran this week of a vegetation-covered mountain covered with trees and foliage and lush green vegetation in Bosnia that's in the shape of a pyramid. And archaeologists have done some work there, and they said, yep, there's stone underneath that, and it's not just natural stone. It was brought there by man. It's cut stone. That's a pyramid in Bosnia. Did you know there are pyramids not only in Egypt? Those are the most famous, of course, and probably the oldest. There are pyramids in China. I have a whole book on that subject in my library. There are pyramids in Europe. There are pyramids in Central America, and there are even some smaller pyramids here in North America. Fascinating subject of study, why there are pyramids. Again, that's a topic for another day. But New Jerusalem is likened to a mountain, pyramid shape. Look at the base measurements given in verse 16 of Revelation 21. The city is laid out as a square. That's what the base of a pyramid looks like. Its length is as great as its breadth. He measured the city with the reed. 12,000 furlongs, its length, breadth, and height are equal. So the city has four sides, just like a pyramid. The length and breadth and height are all equal. While this could be describing a cube, it sounds more like a pyramid, given the mountain shape that we looked at in verse 10. Now, some believe it's multidimensional. Ah, that's very likely. So that the inside might appear as a hyperdimensional cube in four or more dimensions, even though the outside actually appears as a pyramid in three dimensions. You're going to have to Google this, but clearly they'll show you if you step into a pyramid that is multi-dimensioned on the inside, it becomes a hyperdimensional cube. Fascinating to think about. If this city is indeed four-dimensional or greater, then the inside would be bigger than the outside. Now that'll break your brain, I know. I speak from experience. Mine's been broken several times trying to think about this kind of stuff. But it's fun to think about. Now, maybe a good way to illustrate it is using C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. Simple illustration. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the Pevensey children step into a wardrobe. Well, we know a wardrobe to be, at least in our three-dimensional world, a rectangular box somewhere in a bedroom where you would store clothes or something of that nature, right? Ah, but in the Chronicles of Narnia, once you step into the wardrobe, it opens up into the world of Narnia, so that inside the wardrobe is far bigger than outside. Apparently, the New Jerusalem, Garden of Eden, will have the same effect, because it encompasses dimensions that are beyond our own. Perhaps the most compelling evidence that New Jerusalem and Eden are the same is the presence of the Tree of Life in both places. Revelation 22, verse 2, in the middle of its street and on either side of the river was the Tree of Life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. Eating of this fruit, we're told, is one of the rewards for overcomers. Revelation 2, verse 7, to him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the Tree of Life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. I want to eat from that tree, don't you? I'm sure that's the best fruit you've ever tasted. Revelation 22, 14 also says, blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the Tree of Life and may enter through the gates into the city. So we can conclude that eating of the Tree of Life is reserved for those who live in the New Jerusalem. And that's limited to the righteous, faithful saints. Undoubtedly, eating the fruit will be pleasurable, but it seems that the fruit will also impart wisdom needed for ruling. At least this is one theory. Proverbs 3:18, wisdom is a tree of life to them that lay hold upon her. So it's very possible that the fruit will impart wisdom. I've had people say to me, oh, I don't know about being a ruler in the millennium. I wouldn't know the first thing about ruling. Well, just eat some of that fruit, you'll be all right. Now let's consider an additional wonder of this magnificent city of reward. Revelation 21, verse 2, then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. John uses a metaphor to describe New Jerusalem. He paints a picture of the city as a bride, all decked out beautifully for her husband, pointing to the great beauty of the place. But there's a double meaning, for only the chosen, faithful bride of Christ will dwell in the city. The bride will be beautiful for the groom, and the groom's dwelling place will be beautiful for the bride, for it represents the groom himself. Now, I think you're all well aware that it's not the entire church that will be the bride of Christ, it's the faithful church. Those deemed as faithful and righteous who have persevered, at the judgment seat of Christ, they will be deemed righteous and therefore worthy of this reward. And we have a type of that in the Old Testament. When Eve was created as Adam's bride, she was formed by a portion of Adam's body being taken out of him to form Eve. And Adam, the first Adam, is typifying the second Adam, which is Christ. We know that from the New Testament. So it could be that that is picturing that the faithful bride of Jesus will not be his entire body, which is his church, but one portion of his body taken out of him to be his bride, which is the faithful segment of the church. Well, that is a beautiful type. Think on that. Let's give some remarkable characteristics of this new Jerusalem. First, I want you to see the brightness. Revelation 20, verses 10 and 11, he showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. You know, glory is brightness and shining. So the city shines with the glory of God. And so we're told in Revelation 21, verse 23, the city had no need of the sun or of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. No natural lights, only supernatural light, the light of God himself. Do you know there will be no need for electricity in New Jerusalem? Everything outside the city is relatively dark, at least in comparison to the city. And that's why unfaithful believers are said to be relegated to the darkness outside. It's translated in the King James Bible and others as outer darkness, which actually is not the best translation. The darkness outside is the best translation. But that's referring to the darkness, relatively speaking, outside of the New Jerusalem, which is intensely bright. And those outside will not be allowed entrance into the bright New Jerusalem. Look back at chapter 21, verse 11b. Her light was like a most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. Jasper is a beautiful stone. This is something you can look up on the internet. Typically reddish in color, but it can be found in other colors as well. And here it's crystal-like jasper. I envision a translucent reddish hue with ice-like crystals, and it's just gorgeous, so that the city of reward glows with intense and beautiful brightness. It'll be the envy of all the universe. That leads to another remarkable characteristic of New Jerusalem, the dimensions. Revelation 21, verse 16, the city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth. He measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length, breadth, and height are equal. Each of the four sides of the city measures 12,000 furlongs or stadia, about 1,500 miles in length on each side of the city, or 1,500 miles square. That's 2.25 million square miles at the base alone. Comparatively, that's 40 times bigger than the country of England, 15,000 times bigger than London, 10 times bigger than France or Germany, and much larger than the very large nation of India. Randy Alcorn, an author, said a metropolis of this size in the middle of the United States would stretch from Canada to Mexico and from the Appalachian Mountains to the California border. But, I remind you, that would only be two-dimensional, ground-level way of thinking. This city is also 1,500 miles high. Now, I remind you that Earth's atmosphere is only about 300 miles high, so this would extend way, way out into outer space. You think people would be able to see it from Earth as Earth rotates? I have no doubt. Billions and billions of people could live in New Jerusalem and never be crowded. That leads to another remarkable characteristic of New Jerusalem, the wall. Chapter 21, verse 17, then he measured its wall, 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of an angel. So the wall is 144 cubits high. Now, if we use an 18-inch cubit, that would be over 200 feet high. But Petrie, the British Egyptologist, said the cubit used in the Near East in ancient times was not 18 inches, it was 25 inches. Well, if that's the case, then the wall would be over 300 feet high. But why is there a wall? There will be no enemies per se. Ah, yes, but seeing there will be some type of stairway to New Jerusalem from Earth, the wall is apparently to keep out those who don't belong in the city, the unfaithful. Those within the city are with Christ, in his direct presence, both day and night. Those outside are not in his direct presence. They're in his kingdom, but they're like in the village around the castle, not in the castle, if you will. The size of the wall, I think, expresses the magnificence of the city that shoots up 1,500 miles into outer space. Magnificent, with a 300-foot wall. That leads to another remarkable characteristic of New Jerusalem, the gates and foundations. Chapter 21, verses 12 through 14, she had a great and high wall with 12 gates, 12 angels at the gates, and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 on the south, and 3 on the west. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So the wall has 12 gates, 3 on each side of the city, inscribed with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And notice what the gates are made of. 12 pearls. Each individual gate was one pearl. I'd like to see that oyster. This is remarkable, exemplifying the exquisite beauty and the value of this city. Nothing like it on earth, that's for sure. Each gate has an angel posted outside to control who comes and goes. You know all those jokes about Peter at the gates of heaven? Bunch of nonsense. They're funny to laugh at. But don't put any stock in Peter at the gates of heaven. Peter's not going to be at the gates of heaven. The angels will be. And they're not going to stop to ask people why they should be allowed entrance. Jesus will take care of all that at the judgment seat of Christ. And this isn't heaven anyway. It's New Jerusalem, part of the kingdom that hovers over earth. Amazing how we get so warped in our thinking. The wall also has 12 foundations. Some have wondered what this means. Maybe pillars or towers? Having the names of the 12 apostles. Well, that's quite an honor, wouldn't you say? Peter, James, John, and so on. Now notice the multiples of 12. 12 gates, 12 foundations, 12,000 stadia, 144 cubits. Coincidental or providential? I tend to think the latter. At the very least, the number 12 signifies God's number of completeness in government. There could be a whole lot more to this that we don't understand. Many authors have written on this subject alone. That leads to another remarkable characteristic of New Jerusalem, the embellishments. Look at chapter 21, verses 19 and 20. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The stuff that we value so much on earth. Well, the foundations of the building are made out of that up there. The first, jasper, the second, sapphire, the third, chalcedony, the fourth, emerald, the fifth, sardonyx, the sixth, sardius, the seventh, chrysolite, the eighth, beryl, the ninth, topaz, the tenth, chrysoprase, the 11th, jacinth, and the 12th, amethyst. Now, some people say, I've never heard of some of those stones. Well, they are stones that are presently on earth at this point. And if you Google some of these, Google all of them, you'll get pictures of them. Fascinating. These are beautiful stones of variegated colors. Interestingly, these stones are mentioned in connection with Satan in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 28, starting in verse 13. God says to what we know as Satan, we don't know his original name. It's not Lucifer, by the way. That name in the King James Bible with a capital L is actually incorrect. It came to us from the Latin Vulgate as a mistranslation. It literally is not a name, it's a description, meaning creature of light or light bearer, something like that. But that's not his original name. We just know him as Satan or the devil. Don't know his original name. But God says to him, whoever he was initially, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, sapphire, turquoise, emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. God says this to Satan. You see, Satan had also been in Eden, the garden of God, presumably before his fall. We're told he was perfect and without sin, just as Adam was before his fall. He had been one of the cherubim, guarding the presence of God. He was on the mountain of God. Hey, didn't John stand on the mountain and see this new Jerusalem, the Garden of Eden? All one in the same place, I think. Satan had been covered with all these precious stones, the very same stones that we find in the New Jerusalem. That's fascinating. Probably a whole lot more to that than we even begin to understand. That leads to another remarkable characteristic of the New Jerusalem, the streets. Chapter 21, verse 21, the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. Now, the predominant view of Christianity is that these streets of gold are one of the features of heaven, and that all Christians will walk on them one day. And don't you even sing that in the hymns sometimes? It's in our hymns. Walking on streets of gold, seeing those gates of pearl, and so on. Well, that's not correct. These streets are not in heaven, per se. They're in the New Jerusalem, and they're limited to faithful saints. All other believers will be excluded. Ironically, the thing that we value most in our culture as a precious commodity, that is gold, is the substance using for making the streets in the New Jerusalem. The word street in Greek is platia, from which we get our English word plat, or place, or plaza, a marketplace or bazaar that's wide open. The gold is so perfect and free of impurities that it's clear as transparent glass. Not just the streets, but we're told the entire city is golden. 21:18, the city was pure gold like clear glass. Perhaps the gold symbolizes the faithful saints in the city who have been purified and brought forth as gold through trials in life. As if God is saying, you went through all that in life. You came forth as gold. Now live in my city of gold. Wow. These folks have endured their sufferings as Jesus endured his. And now they're rewarded with the privilege of living in a city made of gold. Now, curiously, the city does not have some things. Notice what it does not have. It does not have a temple, for God the Father and Jesus the Son are the temple. Chapter 21, verse 22. There's no sun or moon, for Jesus is the light. Chapter 21, verse 23. There's no night, and therefore no candles or lights are needed, for Jesus is the light. Chapter 22, verse 5. Interestingly, look at verse 24. The nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. New Jerusalem will be so bright that it will lighten the saved nations. Number four, what the city does not have, it does not have a curse in that place. This does not apply to the realm outside of the city, that is, that realm of the kingdom that is the earthly realm at this point in the millennium, because the earth will not have been entirely freed from the curse of sin. In chapter 22, verse 3, we read that New Jerusalem will not have a curse. There will be no curse in that place, but there will still be partial curse on earth. In fact, we know, to support this point, the leaves of the tree of life that are found only in New Jerusalem will be used for the healing of the nations. Why would they need healing if there's no curse? Well, the point is, on the millennial earth, there still will be a partial curse. The word healing here is therapeia, from which we get our English words therapy and therapeutic. Therapy, of course, is treatment intended to relieve or heal a disorder. So these leaves are for restorative healing, perhaps restoring the nations to their original intent. We don't know the full extent of this, but we know there will be no physical death in the New Jerusalem, but there will be physical death on the millennial earth. Those who do not live in the New Jerusalem but reside on earth in bodies of flesh and blood at times may get sick. There will be death. The Bible refers to that in the book of Isaiah. There's even a Gehenna place outside of the walls of earthly Jerusalem, Isaiah chapter 66. All that's very interesting. Perhaps one of the jobs given to faithful rulers in the New Jerusalem will be to travel as paramedics of sorts to heal the nations with the leaves of the tree of life. Now, we don't know how all this works, but if healing is needed, it implies sickness must occur. So these leaves will be used to help heal. Now look at chapter 21 and verse 27 to see something else the city does not have. There's no defilement there. 21:27, there shall by no means enter in it anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. I mentioned in last week's message that I now believe from my studies that the Book of Life is not a listing of those who are regenerated. It's a listing of those who are overcomers, those who are the inheritors. And if you look at every passage in the Bible where the Book of Life or the book is used, they all, at least to me, seem to be in the context of reward / overcoming / inheritance. And that's easily demonstrated in chapter 22, verse 19 of Revelation. If anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part from the book of life, from the holy city, and from the things which are written in this book. Well, that's not talking about losing one's salvation, which is impossible. It's talking about losing one's inheritance. This is loss of inheritance in New Jerusalem. Incidentally, the gates not being shut, chapter 21, verse 25, means that they're open to overcomers, those called out to rule as the bride of Christ. They can come and go as they please. And probably will need to do that in order to carry out their duties. And remember, angels are posted at the gates to turn away those whose names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. I wonder if these angels will be fierce looking and will be sure no one gets in the city who's not allowed. I don't think there'll be any problems with enforcing that rule. Most Christians see the description of New Jerusalem here in our text, and they say this is heaven. This is heaven! And they assume that saints will dwell there forevermore, but that's not correct. During the millennium, believers will live in one of two possible places, either on earth, which is the darkness outside, or in the New Jerusalem, if they are faithful. No one will live in heaven, per se, the place of God's dwelling. Now, in the perfect age of the new earth, everyone will dwell on earth, as I understand it. What then is the New Jerusalem? It's the holy city, the glorious heavenly headquarters of the kingdom, Eden and its garden. But it's reserved solely for those who are deemed faithful at the judgment seat of Christ, and it will be their city of reward. Thus, not all saints will be there. Believers have to qualify to be in this wonderful place, and those who qualify will rule with Jesus during the 1,000-year millennial reign. Chapter 22, verse 5 says, "They shall reign forever and ever." But this uses the Greek word aionios. So it literally translates to the ages of the ages, I believe, referring to the millennium and the age that follows in which Satan stirs up a rebellion. And those ages are the ages of the ages. I mean, they are the focus of all the ages because that's where everything's heading. That's where the conclusion is, where Satan's eventually put down, where Christ rules and reigns and will turn the kingdom over to the Father. Those are the ages of the ages. Then after that, as I said, Jesus will put down all rule and authority and power, and he will turn the righteous kingdom over to the Father. We read about all this in 1 Corinthians 15. The Father will create the new heaven and earth where all mankind will dwell. We close by looking at chapter 22, verses 12 through 14. Jesus says, "Lo, I come quickly, and my reward is with me to render to each as his work shall be. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. Happy are those doing his commands, that the authority shall be theirs unto the tree of the life, and by the gates they may enter into the city." What has been described by Christianity as heaven for all saints is actually New Jerusalem, we could say Eden, for faithful saints. They alone will be the ones who will see Jesus in the millennium, for they will be the ones dwelling in the castle, if we can use that metaphor. All the others will live in the village outside the castle. But those in the castle, as chapter 22, verse 4 says, "They shall see his face, and his name is upon their foreheads." In light of this glorious truth, here's what we should do. Hebrews 12, 14, "Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord." New Jerusalem is far greater than I could ever describe in this message. God says so in his word, essentially. I think he sums it up well in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 9. eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. Notice there's a condition. It's for those who love him. You say, who are those who love him? All Christians? No. Jesus said, if you love me, you will be keeping my commandments. So it's the faithful, obedient Christians. So I ask you, are you ready to meet Jesus? Do you long for the return of Eden, the New Jerusalem? May we cry out with John the Apostle as he closed the New Testament, the book of Revelation, in chapter 22, verse 20. Would you say it with me? Even so, come, Lord Jesus. And I personally think 2023 could be the year of his return. I pray that's the case. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's what we look forward to. Let's bow in prayer.